myelinated versus unmyelinated tissue, or tumors versus a healthy tissue. Again, the T1 and T2 in tumors is different than in healthy brain tissue. So lots of different ways of applying spectroscopy and imaging to get much more information than just proton density, right? So that's the bottom line of that slide. And really, and it sort of, you know, segues right into the motivation of what we're trying to do, which is, can we take those techniques that have been developed, you know, for MRI, and bring them down to the nanometer scale? And if you could, then what would be the advantage? So the advantage would be that there's, you know, life, the length scale from micron to an angstrom or a few angstroms, there's a great deal of, most of life happens on that length scale, right? That's where all the organization of the cells take place. That's where viruses live. That's where macromolecules like proteins reside in that length scale. And if we understand biology on that length scale, there's a tremendous amount of information that we can get. So can we get spectroscopic, three-dimensional, tomographic kind of imaging, but now on the nanometer scale, and be able to look at things like a single folded protein and know where the different chemical constituents sit, what the morphology of this protein is? And if we could, that would really impact, for example, the way we, you know, develop drugs. Or can we take a virus particle and see its see where all the what the proteins are on the surface, what the viral RNA and how it's organized inside? What does that all look like? So that's the goal. And so let me tell you a little bit about how MRI works. So how does one get this kind of information? So if you ever have an MRI done, the inside of the machine looks something like this. There are three sets of coils that can apply magnetic field gradients along the three orthogonal directions. And then you're wheeled into, and then there's a receiver. And here's sort of the receiver that receives the precession frequency from the spin. So what you're doing is you're polarizing, you apply a static magnetic field, you polarize the spins along the direction of the static magnetic field, you apply an RF pulse to tip the spins into the XY plane, and that coherence then evolves, and then you can record the frequency of that precession, right? And depending on how you apply these magnetic field gradients, you can encode information in that precession, or either in the frequency or in the phase. So if you want to encode frequency, so gamma here is the gyromagnetic ratio of the spin. It has units of hertz per Tesla, right? So if I a proton spin in a one to, if H naught was one Tesla, it would precess at 42.6 megahertz. An electron spin has a 660 times larger gamma. At one Tesla field, it will precess at 28 gigahertz. So if you then apply a gradient vector through these set of coils, then a spin at position R acquires a well-defined frequency. And if you then go and measure the spectral content of all the different frequencies in that sample, you're getting some information about the spectral weight, right, of matter at different locations. So you've basically turned spatial information into frequency information, or you can do it with phase as well. So the signal from some little volume of sample, right, is weighted by the spin density and has this frequency. And this is right after you tilt the spins into the XY plane, then it evolves with this time dependence.
Maybe this is the relevant part, but something that I always wondered about, that you're mapping a vector into a scalar, and so you are losing information. And so today you cover it by assuming continuity and
So the vector you're referring to is
the shift in the frequency, for example.
The shift in the frequency
the shift in the frequency is a scalar, but the vector is a position. So you're mapping a position into a single number, the shift in frequency.
Yeah, so there is you in fact don't make one measurement, you make series of measurements. And you, so there's a, I'm going to just get to that. You don't do it just by applying field gradients in every direction and then just letting everything free evolve. Then you do have lost information. Then if you want to recover that information, you have to do something more intelligent. So you would do something like this, for example. So suppose you want to interact, first of all, you have to encode one dimension. So suppose you wanted to flip the spins, but not in the whole sample. You want to selectively, you want to select a certain slice, okay? The way you select the slice is you apply a field gradient. So here, the polarization direction is the z direction. And I'm also applying a magnetic field that increases linearly in z, okay? So then if I apply an RF pulse, and it's actually, the shape matters. The shape is a sinh function, because the Fourier transform of a sinh is a square wave. You apply a sinh function, and this is just the RF envelope, okay? Right, the carrier inside of that is the center frequency, okay? And then at the same time that you apply this RF pulse, you apply a gradient. So that's your gradient. So this means during this time that the pulse is on, you've turned on this gradient. Now you can select only the spins in a particular slice. Depends on what the carrier frequency you've chosen for that pulse is. And it will invert the spins in that slice. So the coherence will only evolve in that slice, nowhere else. Okay, so that's, you've already gained information by this one particular sequence.
So this particular slice will be on resonance?
Exactly.
And then you
can, exactly. You've resonantly, and then depends. So this is where the tomographic, this is where the tomato comes in, right? In the tomato, you're applying that gradient pulse, and all you're doing is stepping the center frequency along the sample. And it's just going through the sample and inverting slice by slice different sections of the tomato. Okay? The next thing you do is you encode the phase within that slice. So now if I take this slice, I'm imagining a cylinder, and I'm looking at the cross-section of the cylinder. What I'm going to do is apply another pulse that follows this one. That is dhz dy. So here's the y direction. So now hz, the field in this direction, is going to vary along the y direction, which is, in this picture, going this way. So what these spins are doing, right, spins are clocks, right? They have a well-defined frequency. If I, the precession frequency. So if I change, if the magnetic field is varying from this point to that point, then the phase that they acquire is different, okay? So I've encoded the phase along that direction by applying this pulse, and then what I do is I follow it with another gradient pulse that applies a gradient in the third direction. And during that time, I record the what's called the FID, the free induction decay. Okay, so after these set of pulses, I'm encoding. I record the FID, and what you can show is that the measured signal that you do by doing this, this is in the two-dimensional slice, is nothing but rho of r, where r is now the two-dimensional vector in the slice, e to the I k dot r. So this wave number here is, you can mathematically show it's just, it's equal to this. This is the wave number, which is the gyromagnetic ratio times the gradient, that's as a function of time, integrated over time, and 0 to t here, t represents the time over which the pulse is on. So what does this look like? It's just a Fourier transform of rho of r. So in fact, the data that you collect is not the real space information, but it's the inverse space information. So you have to Fourier transform this to get back to the real space information. This is why it's like a scattering experiment in a way. So if I had a density, so this, imagine this is one slice of the brain. This picture, let's say, represents rho of r. If I take the Fourier transform of this, I get Q of k. Q of k has spectral weight over some region, significant spectral weight, over some region of momentum space, right? So I don't really need to measure all the way out. I don't need to measure all these high k values. I can just sort of limit myself. I can say, look, I'm just going to restrict my experiment so that I'm going to access the k values in this little box, okay? Then when I do the measurements, what I'm going to do is evolve all those pulse times, okay? When I evolve a the pulse time, remember, that changes what K I encode. And then I'm just going to take the Fourier transform of my data set, and that's going to give me some approximation of the real image, and that approximation can be as good as I like it to be. It depends on how long I want to wait. So this is the gist of MRI imaging. And MRI imaging, of course, has many different forms and many different, you can imagine all different kinds of, you know, pulse sequences and whatever, all kinds of clever tricks to get better information faster and so on. And, you know, I'm not going to obviously dwell on any of that, and not that I know much of that, but I'm not an MRI expert. But this is just the basics of how the thing works, okay? And then, of course, you can do this slice by slice, and then, okay, I also show brains here. This is a brain. There. Okay. All right. So where are we in terms of sensitivity with MRI? So the size of an MRI machine is, of course, designed to be to match the human body, right? So it's of order of a meter long. And the filling factor, which is the fraction of your solenoid that picks up the signal, is large, right? Because the human body takes up most of the volume of the MRI machine, and it's designed to be that way. And, you know, you get information anywhere between, you know, a 1 meter down to about a millimeter, okay? That's about the resolution of MRI. And you can, of course, improve the filling factor by making your coil smaller, and this is microcoil MRI. It's exactly the same technology, only done with little tiny coils. And here you can sort of extend the resolution down to maybe a few microns, and you can look at cells, okay? This technology is relatively new, and large companies are now commercializing micro-MRI machines. But then from a micron down, what do you do? So life, right, the cells are anywhere between 10 microns down to a micron or so, and then virus particles are typically around a few tens of nanometers to 100 nanometers. And then macromolecules, well, those are down in sort of the tens of nanometers. And so what technology is going to span all of this? And there's probably, the answer is there's not going to be any one technology that spans all of this, but you have to target some length scale, and then you have to go after it. So the length scales that we've targeted are starting from here, from about 50 to 100 nanometers, and as low as we can get from there. Okay, so let me just tell you how viruses are currently, so when the CDC comes out and says, you know, we've identified a virus and this is its shape, this is what they're doing. It's Centers for Disease Control. Sorry. I've changed, yeah. Okay, NIH? No. So cryo-electron microscopy. The way this works is that you freeze your sample, you slice it into very thin slices, and you want great many identical copies of the same thing. So in this case, it's this virus particle. And viruses are nice in a sense that they have lots of symmetry to them. So lots of them have icosahedral symmetry, which is what you're seeing over here. And what you do is you shoot very high energy electrons, about 200 kilovolts, well, by very high energy for me, not for you, 200 kilovolts. These electrons scatter off the density profile, and then you collect the electrons on the other side. And if you blow up your target when you do this, but you do it over and over again, and then the sort of the scattering of this of these electrons from many, many targets, over thousands of targets, you build up a data set. And if you know sort of if you build in some constraints based on some symmetry, you can back out the structure of the thing that you're scattering from. So this is actually quite evolved, this technology. And it's of course, its main drawback is that it's destructive. You need many copies of the same thing to be able to image it. You need constraints based on symmetry and so on. So there are lots of things that prevent this to be very widely, to be universally used, but it is the only thing out there right now. This is actually not an image this is just a regular scanning electron image of your sample. But the three-dimensional image comes from then focusing high energy electrons to one of these and then just rastering it across. And as you raster it across, right, depending on your location, it's going to scatter differently on the other side. And that's your data set.
But that'll blow.
That'll blow the thing apart, yeah. And then you go to the next one and you do that one. And then you just keep going. You flash freeze these. So the other trick about biology is so this is all frozen. How do you maintain the biological, so things like molecules, macromolecules don't like being frozen. They change their shape very easily. So to prepare these samples is very tricky. You have to flash freeze them, and there's a way to freeze them in a way that keeps the ice from crystallizing. It freezes so fast, in fact, that it stays amorphous. And if it stays amorphous, then it doesn't distort the molecule. That is a pretty well-developed technique all on its own, to be able to flash freeze something and have something at the end of the day that you can say actually is the thing that I'm trying to image and not something else. Okay, so what we do is very different than what's called inductive detection. So what I described up to that now is inductive detection. So this is, in fact, from a physicist standpoint, much simpler, right? This is just, you know, second law, Newton's second law. I mean, it's just there's a spin. You bring something near the spin that generates a magnetic field gradient. And in the presence of that field gradient, there's a force on the spin and an equal and opposite force on whatever thing that is holding the magnet. So it's the Stern-Gerlach experiment, except now you have your little magnet on a spring, in fact. But you know this particular geometry, it doesn't have to necessarily be like this. There has to be there's always, in this type of detection, there's always a gradient source. And one of either the gradient source or the spin has to be on something that can detect the force, right? But it doesn't necessarily have to be the gradient source. We can also put the spins on the cantilever too and make the...
The laser is there just to take a position on
the position, right. So this is all, again, done at low temperature. So these are done at, you know, millikelvin temperatures or few Kelvin temperatures. And we need to be able to detect the displacement of that little lever in a cryogenic environment. So we usually use some kind of fiber optic to bring the light down and then focus it on this little cantilever. And the cantilevers are pretty small. These cantilevers are maybe like 100 microns long by a few microns wide. Okay, so the displacement of this object has to be detected with a sensitivity that's, you know, a few thousandth of an angstrom. Okay, so we do some interferometric detection to do this. So the way the detection works is it's just mu dot grad b, but of course, you can't really do anything with mu dot grad b by itself, because if you just have this little magnet, it's whatever spins are around are going to interact with it, right? Not only that, as I was explaining over lunch, right, the surface is full of other things that can generate forces. You want the spins to generate a unique force that's only coming from the spins, so you can distinguish it from all the other junk that's around. So magnetic resonance is great for that, right? You can only selectively address the spin. So this bowl-shaped thing that I've drawn here is what we call the resonance slice. So the magnetic field that's generated by the tip is very, you know, non-uniform. If I shine a fixed frequency radiation, then there's just a locus of points that satisfy the resonance condition. And if I move this bowl-shaped thing, this resonance slice, through the spin, then in fact I'm making the spin go through resonance. And when I do that, I can selectively interact with that spin. I can, for example, invert that spin by making it go through resonance.
So you'd be interacting with all the spins
in that resonance slice. That's right. The resonance slice in this realization of the experiment, the resonance slice is laterally quite big. It's a few hundred nanometers. Its thickness, though, it can be down to a few nanometers. Okay. And okay, so let me say something about sensitivity. So if you try to detect a single electron spin this way, what kind of sensitivity would you need? Okay, so an electron spin is roughly 10 to the minus 23 joules per Tesla. The kinds of gradients we can generate with these tips are of order 10 to the 6 Tesla per meter, pretty large. And so that gives rise to a force of 10 to the minus 17 newtons, or 10 attonewtons. So attonewton is the scale of the force that I'm going to be talking about. It's 10 to the minus 18 newtons. So is that a big force? It's a pretty small force, but can we detect it? So these cantilevers that we make ourselves, right? These are lithographically made from single crystal silicon. They're very high quality. The spring constant tends to be sort of, you know, fractions of a millinewton per meter. Resonant frequencies are low. They're, you know, audio frequencies, right? Kilohertz, few kilohertz. Qs are pretty high. And when you cool them down, the thermal fluctuations of the cantilever is what sets the scale of the force that you can detect. And it can be quite small. It can be in the attonewton range. So yes, in fact, you can use these kinds of cantilevers to detect a single electron spin. And we have done that. Let me get to the next slide here. So this is data for scanning over a single electron spin. That bump is the electron spin going through the resonant slice. The thickness here is the thickness of the resonant slice, which was something like 15 nanometers or so. And when you change the external field, right, by 4 millitesla, then that changes the location of the resonant slice and the location where this peak occurs as you scan across the sample. So in fact, you can get three-dimensional information this way, right? You can scan by moving this resonant slice through the sample and collecting data. And then if you know the shape of your resonant slice, you can invert that data set to get back at the spin density. So the way these measurements are made is, I'm going to say a little bit about how we measure. You have to modulate. So this is an 8 kilohertz mechanical object. So you want this force to be resonant with that. This force right now is just a static force. You have to move that frequency from DC to 8 kilohertz. How do you do that? Well, the way it's done in these experiments is that you modulate the spin at 8 kilohertz, okay? And that gives you this force. And the way you do this modulation is what I was saying earlier. By moving this resonant slice through the spin, you can invert it. You do what's called an adiabatic inversion. So every time the resonant slice goes through the location of the spin, it inverts it 180 degrees. And in fact, the motion of the cantilever, by oscillating the cantilever at its resonant frequency and looking for a very slight shift in that resonant frequency, you can identify the spin signal this way. And so here's where, or you can do adiabatic sweeps by using that RF coil. You can sweep through resonance, and then it will invert the spin 180 degrees every time you do an inversion, every time you do an RF sweep. So this represents the frequency of the RF as a function of time. So this is a very short segment of time where the frequency was swept from below resonance to above resonance, and that will invert the spin 180 degrees.
But in this setup, then you're limited to one dimension.
In this setup, we're not limited to one dimension, but we only scanned one dimension for that data set.
No, because, I mean, basically what you're saying is that your digital contact lens is driving the sample, and that driving force is on resonance is a cantilever.
Yes.
But the cantilever has a particular orientation.
Yeah.
So generally you will...
The force is only in one direction, but the spin, the scan direction doesn't necessarily have to be one direction. Yeah. Yeah, the force we're limited to is, we're only detecting the force in the one,
then
in one dimension.
You just have to rotate a sample or something like to...
Why?
Otherwise, again, you're mapping the three-dimensional information to a single you're mapping a vector into a scale.
Well, all you care to know is the location of the spin, right? Not necessarily all the components of the force from the spin. So in order for me to know where that spin resides, I can't just take one set of data. I have to scan this way, I have to scan this way, and I have to scan the bowl through this way.
Yeah.
And then from that data set, I should be able to say where that signal came from.
Yeah. That I agree with.
Yeah.
I guess I don't see how you're doing it this way. I can see how you're doing it this way.
Can you just think about it as moving the sample?
That's what we do.
It's technically easier.
Yeah. Well, we move the sample.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long does the scanning process take?
Well, very long. This was the experiment that I did as a postdoc. This was 2004. Each data point was 13 hours. Yeah, but it's gotten much better since then. But yeah.
What is that?
12 and a half. No. No, right now we haven't done the electron spin measurement, but I would say that we should be able to make this measurement in minutes.
So then to get how many data points do you sample to get a sort of pinpoint the location of the spin on the surface to the sort of nanometer scale?
If you do it sort of a two-dimensional scan, and so yeah, that would probably take you're imaging all the spins in that area, right? Not just one spin, but the order, the time scale for any of these measurements. So if I do, like, I'm going to show you some NMR measurements, is about a week, where we apply, but then you have sort of all the information in 100 nanometer volume. So that is okay, right? So if it takes me a week to image a virus particle, that's fine. That's not a big deal. But we're all always working on improving this sensitivity.
So two questions about the plot. I don't think I understand what the z-axis is, or the y-axis is.
The y-axis.
So the sigma squared spin, what is it you're actually measuring?
Sorry. It'll become more clear later. That refers to the standard deviation of the signal itself, or the variance. So when you measure the spin, we don't ever polarize the spin. We don't know its direction. It's the statistical fluctuation of the spin. Exactly.
Yeah. So it's just zero variance. I guess so. Everywhere else is just dominated by noise in your
yes.
Location.
So the thermal fluctuations dominate the variance everywhere else.
Okay.
So what you in this type of measurement, what you do is you measure in two channels, the in-phase and quadrature channel. So you can be measuring. So you have a particular modulation, right? That modulation has a well-defined phase. So you can measure either in phase with that modulation or 90 degrees out of phase. So 90 degrees out of phase, there's no spin information, only thermal fluctuations. So you can look at that distribution and compare it to the distribution that you have with the in-phase channel. And the difference between those variances is what we call sigma spin.
So that's how you get zero.
Yeah.
Negative
variances.
Right.
Because it's the difference. It's the error in your ability.
The other question I have is, why is there a factor of, there seems to be a huge difference in the size of the signal between 34 and 30 millitesla. Like a factor of two.
Factor of two. So the spin, where you are in the resonance slice determines the strength of the field gradient. The signal grows as the fourth power, as the square of your averaging time goes as the fourth power, but your signal grows as the square of the field gradient. Because it is a variance, you're squaring everything. So, yeah, good observation. But so a few years after, so this is 2009, that same style of experiment was done, only now with proton spins. This is tobacco mosaic virus particles. So it's a little virus, they're rod-like particles. They're about 100 nanometers by, I think, 10 nanometers or so across. And they stuck them to the end of the cantilever. And now the gradient source is stationary, right? And there's a little wire that's patterned under this little pillar, which is the magnet, that generates the RF field. So locally intense RF fields for NMR. and a little field gradient coming from this pillar, this iron cobalt pillar. And the TMV particles are attached to the cantilever. And again, the same kind of resonance slice imaging, but at least they were able to demonstrate that they can get below 10 nanometers of resolution in the, so these are the, each slice by itself. You see sort of two replicas of the virus particle, of this pattern of virus particles. And these two replicas come from the fact that when you go through the resonance slice on the other slide, you get a mirror image of what you had. So it's the shape of the resonance slice as it goes through. You get strong signal on one side and strong signal on the other side. And then from these slices, you can build up then what the three-dimensional spin density looks like. So this is sort of the, this was sort of the state of the art in terms of what can be done with this type of imaging for proton spins, getting to a spatial resolution. So here you see this little white layer down here is a very thin layer of junk that's on the surface of the cantilever. So there's always some hydrocarbon, a few nanometers or a monolayer of hydrocarbon on the surface. So they're actually able to see that. And on top of that, so this is a cross section taken this way. No, that's just there. We just it's just because you have to dip coat these little tips into the virus particles. There's always something that gets on there. And then this cross section here is the cross section of the tobacco mosaic virus particle. That's pretty cool. No real, it doesn't excite biologists, but as far as MRI goes, it's really, a tour de force. So.
Now, is there a big difference? So I guess the difference between this and the electron spin is sensitivity. You said earlier, putting the tip on the cantilever or the sample being measured on the cantilever.
So.
One sort of
quality. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about that in this slide. So the biggest source of noise or the biggest problem here is the surface. So this 2.5 atom newtons per root hertz that I showed earlier for based on the Q and the thermal fluctuations is never really realized in an experiment. And that's because when you get near the surface, there are non-thermal fluctuators or there are other fluctuators besides just KT. There are charges. There are all kinds of things that are fluctuating. There are charges on your cantilever. There are charges on the surface. And these can overwhelm the low-frequency fluctuations. And in fact, when you go and measure the spectral content of these fluctuations, you find that there's like a 1 over F behavior. So it's very, very common, right? So it's some activated process. At low frequencies, it really shoots up. And at high frequencies, it dies down. And if these fluctuations overlap your cantilever, right, it degrades the quality factor, right? So, so really, what you have to contend with is always the combination of the thermal part, which is this 4 Boltzmann constant temperature times gamma, which is the dissipation of the mechanical object. This is the intrinsic part, and whatever the surface gives you. And in these measurements, since these were done with audio frequency levers, it's really problematic because at those low frequencies, when you get near a surface, there are lots of fluctuations. And that's really what lowers the quality factor. So in the subsequent measurements in the TMV particle, so they took great pains to sort of put a, control the surface as much as possible to minimize that effect. And they were able to minimize it to a greater effect, to a greater extent than they could with the earlier work, but not at all what they're capable of measuring. Okay, still far away from what they could do.
So the Q that you were quoting earlier, is that the intrinsic Q?
That's the intrinsic Q. The Q degrades by a factor of 10 at least when you get close to the surface. Yeah. In 8 kilohertz, with these 8 kilohertz levers. So what we started to think about was, well, how do you get around these issues of the surface? So that's where we started from, can we really extend these measurements all the way down to the thermal limit? If you can, you can extend the spatial resolution down to just a few nanometers, which would be amazing. So where we started out was just considering the mechanical properties of a cantilever. So you can think of a cantilever as just a bar. So a bar with a circular cross section and some length. And so the thermal fluctuations are set by 4 kBT gamma. So lower the temperature, the better. Gamma is the intrinsic dissipation. The lower you can make that, the better. And gamma is given by the spring constant divided by the frequency of the oscillator times its quality factor. So this is, right, when I talk about the spring constant, I'm talking about the lowest flexural mode of this bar. And, you know, how soft is it? And just from basic elasticity theory, you can show that this quantity is proportional to the mass of the oscillator times the something that looks like an aspect ratio, right? The radius divided by the length squared. So if I want to make gamma small, I want to make things that are very small radius, very long, like a little whisker. And I want to make them very high quality, very low intrinsic dissipation, very low defects, and as small a mass as possible. Okay. And so instead of lithographically making these things, right, the way you do that is you start with a big wafer, you have a mask, you pattern things, you etch things down, and so on. We said, why don't we self-assemble them? Why don't we grow them? Because there's this wonderful technology that was developed that really started to develop around 2000 called vapor liquid solid growth. Actually, it dates back to quite a bit earlier than that, to the 50s, but it really took off in the late 90s. So the way VLS growth works is it's incredibly simple and very, very robust. So if you want to grow, so you can grow many different materials this way. So we grow silicon, that's sort of the canonical material. So if you want to grow silicon, you take a silicon substrate, it has, and then you put some gold particles on it. So these gold particles are something like, you know, a few tens of nanometers across. So you do this by dispersing the gold particles in solution, which you can buy commercially, and you drip them onto the surface of a silicon substrate. And then you put it into a furnace, and you introduce silane gas. So silane is silicon with some hydrogens on it. And silane will react with, if you crank up the temperature high enough, over 700 degrees, the silicon will start, the hydrogens will dissociate on the surface, and the silicon will just basically go into the onto the surface, and you'll just keep growing silicon. But at lower temperatures, there's a catalytic reaction. The barrier for the hydrogens to pop off the silicon is actually lower on the surface of the gold than on the surface of the silicon. So at around 450 degrees, the hydrogens will dissociate, and the silicon will start going into the gold. It looks like just like growing a rod of sugar. If you ever, as a kid, you grew, you know, take a super saturated solution of sugar, and then you put a little piece of sugar on it, it just kind of grows off of that piece of sugar. It's the same thing. You dissolve the silicon into this little particle of gold, it supersaturates the gold particle, and it starts to precipitate out as a single crystal. And the gold acts as a template. It only does it under the gold, and it'll just precipitate out a nice little rod of gold, silicon for you. And the longer you keep the reaction going, the longer you can grow these little lampposts. So we grow them to about 20 microns long, and diameters between 50 and 100 nanometers, okay? And they're beautiful because the silicon here is not touching anything, okay? It's completely unconstrained. So any defects and things that happen during growth, there's no stress on the surface. It forms very few defects. And if you prepare the surface right, it'll make a crystallographic attachment to the surface. And it will be just a single crystal rod of silicon that's growing off of your substrate. So it's really a perfect kind of mechanical device. But so they're quite small. Okay, so this is a scanning electron an SEM image of it, so kind of deceiving. That scale bar is 5 microns. So let me just give you a sense of scale here. So that's a red blood cell. Okay, so the thickness of this. So the height of this mechanical object is about the half the width of a normal human hair, okay, which is about 20 microns or so. Okay, the diameter of this object is about the size of a virus. Okay, they're incredibly small little things. And this is what we're going to use as our mechanical sensor. Okay, but the force sensitivity is quite good. It's, you know, you can get to, at 4 Kelvin, you can already get to 1 outer newton of force sensitivity. We're planning on cooling these things down to 300 millikelvin. We should be down to, you know, well under a new, an outer newton, just a few tenths of an outer newton.
So what sort of Q factors?
Getting there. So the Q factors can be anywhere between 40 and 70,000. Also quite good. But much lower mass and much higher frequencies. So what's an outer newton? So this is, I apologize for the slide, but it kind of gives you a scale, right? An apple is, the weight of an apple is about a newton. The weight of a postage stamp is about, 10 millinewtons. And the weight of a red blood cell is about 3 by 10 to the minus 13 newtons. So it's still five orders of magnitude larger than an outer newton. And so the weight of a large molecule is about an outer newton. Okay? So pretty small forces. And so we have to, so in order for this measurement to work, we have to measure the displacement of these little whiskers with a precision that's down to, you know, a few thousandth of an angstrom. And again, we use interferometry for that, but we do a little trick. We polarize the electric field from the laser that's hitting this little wire so that the electric field is parallel to the axis of the wire. That in fact enhances the backscattered light, the reflectivity of the wire, by about a factor of 50 as compared to if you polarize it in the perpendicular direction. So this gives us better sensitivity. But still, the reflectivity of these little wires is still only about 1%, so quite low. Nonetheless, we can cool them down, and we can get displacement sensitivities that are, you know, in the fraction of a picometer per root hertz type level, which is what we need to do. As far as the dissipation, which is really the thing that we care about, it turns out that when we operate these things near a surface, so the resonant frequency of these things are really high. The resonant frequency ranges anywhere between half a megahertz to a megahertz. Remember, the other ones were at 8 kilohertz or a few kilohertz. So this 1 over F problem is not really an issue. We can get very, very close to the surface and stay at the intrinsic noise limit, less than 10 nanometers. And so the overall dissipation, we've have an improvement of about a factor of 300 from the previous experiments. And if you just put some numbers to this, if we could get gradients, even at a gradient of 2 by 10 to the 6 Tesla per meter with some realistic operating conditions, you can see protons in a volume where the lateral size of the box is about 2 nanometers. Okay, and so there's really a lot of potential here to go all the way down to, you know, just a few nanometers to a single nanometer. And that's really the length scale you want to be at if you want to start looking at macromolecules. For things like viruses, this is already really pretty good.
But it seems like you're still, so that the issue of freezing them is still an issue.
It's still an issue. For us, it's still an issue. But, you know, for any realistic imaging, anything that's realistically going to image something biological on the nanometer scale, it has to immobilize it, because all biology on that scale fluctuates. And the timescales of the fluctuations are way too fast for any imaging. Okay, so in the before where we, you know, what we did was we modulated mu z. We wanted a force at resonance, so we modulated mu z and we had a static field gradient. Now we need to do this up at a megahertz, and modulating mu z becomes extremely problematic. You need very, very large B1 fields from the microwave source to do this kind of manipulation adiabatically. And so what we opted to do was to actually not really modulate mu z so much, only very slowly, but really make the field gradient time dependent. So we changed the experiment yet in another way. Instead of a static field gradient source, what we have is a wire. This wire is made of silver. It's patterned on magnesium oxide, so it has very good contact to the magnesium oxide. It makes an epitaxial contact. So that means the lattice of the silver is matched to the lattice of the underlying substrate. And we pattern a very small constriction in this wire. Here, I'll show you in more detail here. This is an optical image. You can't really see the constriction here, but this constriction is 1 to 200 nanometers across. You can see it's very, very abrupt. And the marvelous thing about these constrictions is they will sustain a very high current density. It's because the idea is if you can make the metal film have a very long mean free path for the electrons, then the electron really only drops voltage or loses energy when it collides with something, right? In these collisions. So if you can make the size of your constriction small compared to the mean free path, then you can you have ballistic transport of electrons, not diffusive, and so you can, in fact, you might be able to sustain a much higher current density there than you could in a metal. In a normal wire, if you get to a current density, so if I have a copper wire, right, and if I put in a current density of something like 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 7th amps per centimeter squared through that wire, I will blow it up. I will melt the wire. And that's because the wire microscopically is full of little defects. And when you apply that current, they start, in the presence of that electric field, they start moving around. And when they start moving, right, or through the collisions of the electrons, they start moving around. And when they start moving around, the metal actually starts to heat up. It dissipates heat energy locally. But people have shown that if I have a single crystal metal, it can support several orders of magnitude more current density without having anything happen. So you just really need not to have diffusive transport. And we can put in excess of 10 to the 9th amps per centimeter squared. We haven't really blown one of these things up in an experiment. Our amplifiers always peg before the constriction blows out. So we can put in this little thing, 200 milliamps of current time alternating, and keep it going for hours and hours or days or weeks or whatever. It just does not blow up. It's great. The wonderful thing about that is that the field gradient you generate over that constriction is proportional to your current density. So you can get to current densities that are larger than 10 to the 6 Tesla per meter. The wonderful thing is you can turn them off. If you want to do spectroscopy, another bad thing about having the static gradient source is you want to apply all these pulses. You can't do gradient pulses because the gradient is always there, right? Here you can actually turn the thing off and modulate it at whatever frequency you want. And you can get to very, very large time-varying fields in excess of a kilogauss when you're near that little constriction. So the field lines right over the constriction look like this. So if I modulate the current here at the Larmor frequency and I apply a static field in the z direction, I have a very large B1 field, right, perpendicular to B0, which is what I need to do magnetic resonance. If I can also modulate this current at the cantilever frequency, and then through the field gradient, dBz dx, I can couple the spins in this sample to the mechanical motion of the oscillator. So it's used as a dual-purpose device, both to excite the spins and to read off the spins. Okay? And to do this, we came up with this little protocol, which we call MAGIC, where we, for some period of time, we do an adiabatic sweep by modulating the current at the Larmor frequency and sweeping through resonance. We invert the spins slowly. This is done at just a few kilohertz. And then in between these inversions, we modulate the current. This is the envelope of the modulation that I'm showing you at the resonance frequency of the lever. And we alternate that 180 degrees with the inversions. The reason why we do this is because if we were to modulate the current right at the resonance frequency, there's electric fields generated by this current too. Those also couple to the lever. They will strongly drive the cantilever. Okay? But by alternating the phase of the modulation 180 degrees, there's no Fourier component here of this modulation at the cantilever frequency. It's all in the sidebands. But since you're inverting the spin 180 degrees synchronously with this, the force from the spin lands exactly on resonance. So it's a very clean way. All your modulation is outside the bandwidth that you're interested in.
Okay. Milliseconds.
So the time scale here, just to give you a sense, this would be probably be, in the experiments we've done, this is probably a kilohertz, and it'll go up to about 4 kilohertz in the next set of experiments. Yeah. So it's, hundreds of microseconds to a millisecond.
You're saying the electric field driving it is at a smaller frequency, or?
So what I'm saying is this. If I have, so the modulation looks something like this if I draw it schematically. So if I draw, so let's say I do n cycles, or let's say, you know, two cycles here, or 2.5 cycles, whatever. So let me draw it a little bit better. Sorry. Let me start here. Let's say my modulation does this. And then here, I put a little gap in time, and then I start over here. So I've inverted the phase 180 degrees from what it would be. So if I take this time record and I Fourier transform it, then what I get is, so the center frequency here is the cantilever frequency, so let's call that omega C. I will get a series of sidebands. There's no Fourier component of this waveform at omega C, only at the sidebands. And this separation here is essentially the amount of time it takes to go from there to there, 1/ that time. So this delta omega, so delta F here is proportional to, right, 1/ this period.
And you assure that you're driving the cantilever in the linear regime, so there's no frequencies.
Oh, the cantilever is driven by a few angstroms of motion. And it's 20 microns long. Yeah. Yeah. So if, you know, the response function of the cantilever looks something like this, right? So these spikes are all in the tails. And in fact, we get rid of these spikes too by, there are ways of minimizing the force. So the coupling, this is due to the electric fields generated by the currents. If you ground one side and drive with V plus on the other side, that's the worst possible thing to do because the center here has a non-zero voltage. But if you make this V plus and this V minus, then the voltage is a null in the center. And in fact, by playing with that, you can make these things go way down so that you're even the spurious stuff is really minimized. Yeah. So you drive differentially. Okay. I'm glad you're interested in all these details. I wouldn't have expected a particle physicist from asking me that, but I'm glad. So this is the apparatus. This is the microscope that we've built. It has, you can imagine there's all kinds of positioning you need. Right, you need to do this at cryogenic temperatures. This is the little chip you can see here with the little nanowires coming off. This little thing down here is the constriction, what we call, quote unquote, the sample. It's because it's always the sample that we scan, but it's really the constriction. The sample is the little bit of protons that we put on the end of the nanowire. And then there's this tube you can see coming here. There's a tiny, so the length scale here is this distance from there to there is about a millimeter, okay? And so these are all on stages, and these stages are actuated by piezo ceramics, and each stage can be positioned with nanometer precision in X, Y, and Z directions. So that way, we can actually bring the constrict, we can use these positioners to place one wire in the on the laser, and then we can then use that wire as an AFM probe and then scan the surface of the sample to find where the constriction is and then position the nanowire right over the center of the constriction. And that process takes about, in the hands of an experienced graduate student, 1 day to do. So there's about a 1 day setup time to do the experiment. Not including cooling. Anywhere, it can be infinite. So the current graduate student is also quite good. One of our stages broke, and he fixed it remotely. He rebuilt one of the stages, which is pretty amazing. But because they're pretty tricky things to put together, but he can now do it probably on the same order. So it took him about, I don't know, a year or so of working with the instrument, of getting comfortable with it, and so on. There's quite a lot to it, but once you know what's going on, then it's not that hard. It's time consuming, and then you have to cool things and so on. So things take a little time.
So sorry, the volunteer is still put, say, if you're trying to look at a virus.
Yes.
The virus
on the tip.
On the tip. These wires.
Yeah, and then bring it over the constriction. That's the goal, exactly. So we didn't do it with a virus yet, but we did do it with polystyrene. So we took a wire. So this is 50 nanometers across here, and then we dipped it into the last micron of the wire, not all of the wire. The last micron of the wire, we dipped into polystyrene liquid, and that makes this nice little coating. Well, polystyrene is nice because it's proton dense. Okay, and so there's a chip. There are many of these wires growing. We identify the wire we want to work with. We put it under an optical microscope with a micromanipulator. We have these micromanipulators that they use for in vitro fertilization. You'd like the, you know how they hold the cell and then they poke it. It's the same thing. And then you basically take a droplet of whatever you want to put on the tip, and you bring it into the nanowire. And then you can actually see these wires under an optical microscope, because you just polarize the light from you use polarized light from the microscope, and then you can just see the wires. And then you dip coat the end. And then this is how we imagine doing the actual experiments too, is where we would have, this is just an, we didn't really make an array, but what we're building now, one of the instruments we built, we got these wires through a collaboration, because you need a pretty fancy setup to grow the wires. But now we're actually buying a commercial system to grow the wires. So we're going to be able to do this in rack, actually, and at IQC. And we're going to be making regular arrays of these wires. So the idea would be you have many, many of these wires near an edge, and you then go and functionalize them with different things. And then you take the whole array and cool it down, and you can bring them over the constriction one by one to do the imaging.
It'll be your test tubes.
Yeah.
Your array of test tubes.
Exactly. And so what we wanted to know was, can we image the polystyrene in this little tip? Let me just say one other thing. We work with statistical fluctuations, not the thermal polarization. So the thermal polarization follows the Curie law, right? Which is the fraction that of the spins that are polarized is given by magnetic moment times field divided by KT. But if I look at protons, right? So these are at different temperatures, and I'm assuming an external field of 1 Tesla. This is the polarization as a function of ensemble size for thermal polarization. And this is the root n fluctuations of a spin a half system as a function of ensemble size. And you can see that at 10 to the fourth, right, I would have to be at 100 millikelvin to have the same amount of thermal polarization that I can just from the root n fluctuations. Really what we are is at 6 Kelvin or so in these measurements. And we're looking at ensembles in a volume of 10 nanometers on a side. So it's much better to work with the statistical root n fluctuations. The downside is you don't know which way they're pointing, right? So you have to have a protocol for imaging that allows you to deal with that uncertainty. The signal that we measure is the signal power. We have to square again because we're dealing with these randomly oriented spins. And this is what the your SNR is then proportional to the number of spins, the gradient squared divided by the force noise, right? And the measurement bandwidth, of course. So this is not imaging, but just simply detection, just to see if we were at the thermal limit. These are protons. They have these statistical fluctuations have a certain intrinsic correlation time, right? There's some realization that evolves and will change, become an independent realization on a time scale, which we call tau m. And that time scale for protons for polystyrene is a few hundred milliseconds. So pretty long, in fact. And we did, in fact, show that we could get to the very close to the thermal limit in these measurements. How do we do imaging? We do that magic protocol, which reads out the spins over the entire sample, over this 100 nanometers. But then we interject some periodic set of encodings. So what these encodings do is exactly what I was telling you in the MRI imaging measurements. So I'm going to show you the simplest possible encoding you can do, which doesn't give you spatial resolution, just shows that you can encode a coherence. What I'm going to do is what's called a Ramsey fringe experiment, where we invert the spins into the plane by 180 degrees, by 90 degrees, excuse me, all the spins in the sample. We let them evolve in the external field. We turn off all the gradients. We turn off everything. Just the static external field is on. We let them evolve in that field, and then we tip them back to the z-axis and then read them out. And then we're going to do this. We're going to impose these encodings on a time scale that's fast compared to the statistical correlation time, which I've called tau m. So if you do that, so imagine you're inverting the spin 180 degrees. The statistical fluctuations have some correlation time that's long, but then let's say every 10 milliseconds, you invert the spin 180 degrees. This is what your signal would look like, okay? Some randomly varying amplitude and phase, but you have a well-defined clock that's determined by where you've done the encoding. And so the measured signal is then just proportional to this integral over all your spin density times this kernel. This kernel for this free evolution is very simple. It's just given by whatever decay function describes your T2 decay times the cosine of this phase factor, right? This phase factor is whatever is acquired in that free evolution time in the static external field B0. And the envelope function for polystyrene, it turns out it's a Gaussian, and it has some correlation time T2 star given by 14 microseconds. And so these are the Ramsey fringes, right? So this is the actual oscillations that you observe as you change the evolution time and then read out. And then this is the envelope of these oscillations as a function of longer time so that you can identify what T2 is. The reason why I'm so excited about this very simple measurement is it could never be done on this scale with conventional MRFM the way it was done in the past. And it relies on the fact that you'd be able to turn off the fields and have this to be able to record this free evolution, right? So you couldn't do this kind of, this is really a spectroscopic technique, right? You take these oscillations, you Fourier transform it, and then you get the spectrum. And of course, if you can do that, then you can do imaging, a la Fourier transform imaging, because what you can now do is during that free evolution time, you can apply a gradient pulse. Of course, we can't apply linear gradients here because we don't have nice coils where, like Helmholtz coils or something like this. We have this little constriction. So it's going to generate very non-uniform gradients, but that's okay. As long as we know what they look like, we're fine. So if I apply just a static current pulse, so there's no carrier here. It's just a pulse of current that's on for this amount of time during the evolution time. Then I encode contours of constant Larmor frequency, which I've called V contours right here. And then if I then follow this evolution by another nutation pulse, so this is a resonant pulse at the Larmor frequency, but because I have a very non-uniform B1, right, B1 is changing as I go, is decreasing strongly as I go up, then the angle that I've tipped the spins in the effective field, in the effective rotating frame, is different because of the strength of B1 varies. So then I encode contours of constant B1, or what I've called U contours. So you can see I have this curvilinear coordinate system, and through this set of pulses, I can record the data for different pulse lengths, and that encodes spins in this two-dimensional curvilinear. I take the projection of this droplet onto this curvilinear space. So this is my kernel now in this, with these pulses present. You can see these are now position dependent. Before I was just doing a free evolution, these were just position independent, but now these are position dependent. So if I do a cosine transform, a two-dimensional cosine transform of that data set, I recover the spin density in this curvilinear space. And that's what that image is. So it's a very distorted image of that tip. That's because I'm in this UV space, but if I know my geometry, I know how UV maps to XY, I can just transform that back to XY coordinates. And then this is the NMR image of the proton density of that tip projected into the UV coordinates. And you can see the overall shape is consistent, but moreover, you can see the sort of hollow region where the spin density is low. That's because there was a gold ball there. And you can see sort of the outline of the silicon rod that's underneath. That's also because there's less protons under there. And you can compare that to what you would expect based on the SEM of the image of the tip, right? The SEM of the tip, I went through that rather quickly. Here's the actual SEM. And you can see there's about 14 nanometer thick coating of polystyrene under that catalyst particle. And that's about our spatial resolution too. It's about 10 nanometers. You can just barely resolve the that proton coating. And it compares very well to simulation based on the actual image. So really the stuff that I'm setting up to do right now is, these were just proof of concept experiments, but there's a lot of room for improvement, and we think we can get a much better signal sensitivity than what we could in these measurements. These were just to get on the board and just to be able to show that we could do this. What I'd like to do is electron spin imaging this way. We have the sensitivity to see single electrons, so we can do things like labeling molecules, macromolecules with spin labels, and then imaging where those labels sit. That would be a fantastic experiment. If you can do electron spins, and you can do many other kinds of experiments, coupling electron spins to nuclear spins. One of those is what's called dynamic nuclear polarization, and it's a way to boost the so protons, right, at low temperatures, at a Kelvin, at these fields, at a Tesla field, are polarized to near unity, but the polarization of the protons is minuscule. If there's hyperfine coupling between the electrons and protons, so you can then transfer you can polarize the electron spin reservoir and transfer that polarization into the nuclear spin, hyperpolarizing the nuclear spins. So you can get, if you can do that, then you can do real thermal type imaging. That is, you have a well-defined phase. All the spins are initialized to the same state. You don't have to deal with this randomly fluctuating signal. That actually would improve signal sensitivity by a lot. And if you can polarize them to the same level you could do electrons, it would be, you know, push the spin set, the signal strength by several orders of magnitude, by at least two orders of magnitude. So that is something that I'm gearing up to do as well. And again, most of the experiments that I talked about are geared towards biology, but there are experiments that I want to do using these techniques to also look at electrons in correlated materials, for example, in superconductors. Okay?
Very cool.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And let me just, well, that's, if you want to do three-dimensional imaging, you can also build this kind of structure to do three-dimensional imaging. And those are the students, some of the students involved. So everything that I showed, actually, all the data came from John, who's now a postdoc with Amir Jacoby. Amir is actually here at IQC also. And then the new students are, so Bill is doing most of the measurements these days, and Will and Angela are also quite involved. And Bill just, I mean, Brian just wanted to show up for the picture, but he's involved in other projects. So anyway, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, don't worry about it. So any questions or any comments or?
I have one question for you about general MRI. Has it ever been used for isotopic measurements?
Sorry, what type of measurements?
isotopic, so...
Isotopic, yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah, absolutely. With helium, I mean, they use helium. Well, they don't use it to distinguish one form of helium from another, but they do use helium 3 as a contrast agent for. They hyperpolarize. How does this work? They do this with hyperpolarized xenon, and I think they've done it with hyperpolarized helium-3. You can hyperpolarize, you can through some optical techniques, these, like, I think, xenon or helium-3. And once they're hyperpolarized, the decay is, if you keep them in the right vessel, the decay is through collisions with the walls of this thing. And so they... As you know, the decay time is quite long. So if you then give that to a patient, the patient inhales it, and basically there's a polarization and transfer to the protons, and or you can actually look at the where that goes in the lungs, for example. So there are techniques like that that I'm aware of, but to identify one isotope from another in the body, I don't know if that is. Been done. Doesn't mean it hasn't.
So I guess for us the figures of merit is 4 × 10⁻¹⁸ newton is measurable on that scale of nanometer.
Yeah. I mean,
I guess the critical thing is that force is better half the magnitude.